I'm John Rosenberg, and this is the second in the Niebuhr series, Reinhold Niebuhr and His Critics. This one's called They're Okay Until You Get Them in Bunches, which is a treatment of Niebuhr's social and political thought based on moral man and immoral society. And the title comes from what is the basic point of that book. They're okay until you get them in bunches. He's talking about people there. And if you understand that, you can... You probably don't have to buy the book. Somebody was asking me if they should buy the book. And if you understand about people that they're okay until you get them in a group, then you know the point that Reinhold Niebuhr was trying to make about them. Somebody asked me why I like him so much, and I guess I like him because he's bald, if you saw the picture of him out there. good guy. One of the things I found out about just now from Bob Baker is in the reading room, which is on the other side of the Village Center there. There are some a couple of current magazines that I referred to yesterday that people can go in and read, and I'm going to be referring to a couple of these today. One of them is a Christian Century issue in which Robert McAfee Brown and Michael Novak, who are these two people, one of which is a neoconservative and one of them is sort of a liberal liberation theologian, and both claim Niebuhr, write two articles about Reinhold Niebuhr. And we can read what McAfee Brown has to say about him and Novak has to say about him. Another one is an older issue. It's I'm going to talk about it a little bit today. It's called Niebuhr versus Niebuhr. It's a series of articles from the Christian Century in the 1930s when the Japanese attacked Manchuria. And Reinhold Niebuhr had one response as to how he thought the United States ought to respond to that situation. And his brother H. Richard had an opposite kind of a response. And they sort of carried on a brotherly dialogue in the pages of the Christian Century, and it's been reprinted here. So those are available in the reading room. And then a couple of issues of Christianity in Crisis that were occasioned by the publication of the Fox biography. They're right after each other, but they're all review articles about that book specifically and about Niebuhr in general from people that knew him and people that are writing on the theological scene. And interestingly enough, Christianity in Crisis was a magazine that Reinhold Niebuhr began right before the Second World War. As kind of an effort to try to get the United States away from an isolationist position and to be active with the Allies in World War II, and called the magazine Christianity in Crisis. It's still being written today, and this was the 45th anniversary issue of it, and it's appropriately titled Remembering Reinhold Niebuhr. So those are a couple of things that you can look at up in the reading room. Niebuhr's social and political thought was significant, as I said yesterday, far beyond his what you would normally think. I said he was a preacher, and he had influence far beyond what you would normally associate with a preacher, and beyond religious and theological circles. He really, I think, helped to influence a whole generation of politicians and statesmen. His thinking lies in the background of a lot of the post-World War II American foreign policy. Things like the Cold War, the containment policy, the Marshall Plan, things that we associate with the United States foreign policy after the Second World War were policies that Niebuhr had a hand, at least, in helping to formulate with some other kind of people. And I talked a little bit about that yesterday. His ideas on religion and politics and social relationship occupied him during his whole lifetime. He was always interested throughout his life in the relationship between Christianity and social ethics, between religion and politics. I mean, that was really what he dealt with. He was a professor, as I said yesterday, of applied Christianity at Union Seminary, and he dealt primarily with social and political ethics. That's what he talked about, and wrote a lot of editorials. He was very active politically during his life. He was active in the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is still around. Some of you may be active in it as well. He was active in an organization called the Fellowship of Socialist Christians. He was very active in the Socialist Party. He ran for office a couple times during the 30s on the Socialist Party ticket in New York. He helped to found something that some of you may be familiar with called the Americans for Democratic Action, which was kind of a liberal wing of the Democratic Party that people like Hubert Humphrey were active in. And so he was the kind of person that, during his prime, you'd pick up almost any political organization that was sort of on the left side or the center of the political spectrum, and you'd see his name along the left-hand margin among the people that founded it and, you know, were on the board of directors. He lent his name freely to all sorts of social and political causes. Initially, he was critical of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal because he talked about it as being piecemeal reformism. He just didn't feel like the New Deal was radical enough. He thought the United States needed something similar to a kind of a socialist type of, not necessarily a revolution, but a whole new way of handling the economy. And he felt like the New Deal was just kind of, you know, piecemeal. It wasn't quite radical enough for him during the 30s. He was influenced by socialist and by Marxist thought. And when you read Moral Man and Immoral Society, you will see that. It comes through again and again. He was especially influenced by Marxist, the critique in Marxism of capitalism and of, you know, what Marxists would call bourgeois, upper middle class culture and sensibilities. Now, later on, in the late 30s and in World War II, he became a real committed New Dealer. So he kind of went through a change in his life. He became a Democrat rather than a socialist. He was a strong anti-communist in the sense of he really felt the Soviet Union needed to be opposed after the war. He was what you would call, I guess, a critical patriot. He was very patriotic, very patriotic. He loved the United States, but he was critical about it. And he developed a school of thought called Christian realism. That's, you know, if he's got a name for his philosophy of politics and Christianity, that's what it's known as, Christian realism. His social and political thought is apparent throughout his life and his work. He made two major statements, I think. His major statements appear in two of his major works. One of them was one that he published in 1932 called Moral Man and Immoral Society, which I want to talk about today. And the second one was one I referred to yesterday called The Nature and Destiny of Man, and that was in two volumes, and particularly Volume 2, which is called Human Destiny, deals a lot with political ideas. Now, a lot of his other stuff also dealt with political kinds of considerations. He wrote a book called The Children of Light and The Children of Darkness, in which he really tried to make a case for democracy. And he wrote a lot of stuff. There was one called Christianity and Power Politics. You can just read the titles of his stuff, and you can see that he was interested in that. But I think those two works really have kind of his mature, or his major political reflection, or he says it the best. He kind of repeats himself. When you write as much stuff as he did, I guess you tend to repeat yourself a little bit. And these two works appear the major outlines, I think, of his social and political thought, although he wrote a great deal more. He wrote a book called The Irony of American History in 1952, which is a really good book, and then The Children of Light and The Children of Darkness, and a lot of other stuff. Some of it's in the library here. I think it's good to remember when you're dealing with Niebuhr, and when you're dealing with anybody, but especially Niebuhr, that he went through a rather profound political and theological metamorphosis during his lifetime. When he died in 1971, he wasn't the same person, and he didn't have exactly the same ideas that he did in 1932 or 1928. You know? And that's probably true of all of us, but it's good to remember that when you're dealing with him, because he did go through a kind of a change. And like Martin Luther, he developed his ideas in response to concrete historical situations, using his theological ideas to interpret experience and using experience to temper his theological ideas. I talked a little bit about that yesterday. But his life was kind of this constant dialogue between his theological ideas and what was going on in his life and what was going on in history. And the two influenced each other. He used his theological ideas to interpret what was happening in history, and he used what was happening in history to temper and to kind of clarify and in some cases change some of his theological ideas. There's a word that people use today and I use it in its broadest sense, but people in liberation theology talk about praxis. And one of the things about praxis is that there's this constant dialogue going on between what's happening and what you're involved with and theology, and they influence each other. And you know, I don't know if Niebuhr would claim that he was into praxis, but in a way there's some similarities there. The early statement of his political and social ideas is that book, Moral Man and Immoral Society. I said yesterday, Niebuhr was not into inclusive titles, so he used a man in the generic sense. Some people say he didn't use it in the generic sense, even though he thought he did. That was republished again in 1960, you know, so almost 30 years after he originally wrote it, and he wrote a new preface for it, and this is what he says. He says, the central thesis was, of this book, was and is, that the liberal movement, both religious and secular, seemed to be unconscious of the basic difference between the morality of individuals and the morality of collectives, whether races or classes or nations. Niebuhr was, I guess you'd call him a liberal in the truest sense of the word. You know, he comes from that end of the theological spectrum, theological liberal, and the political spectrum as well. And so, and he was very critical of liberals. He was critical of his own people, in a sense, and this book especially brought that out. So he was kind of a liberal talking to other liberals, saying, you know, this is what's wrong with what we think in that book. In the introduction to the book, I got a kind of an extensive quote here, but I think it really tells you what he was trying to do. He says, what is lacking among all these moralists, and again, he's talking about himself and his own folks, the liberals, whether religious or rational, is an understanding of the brutal character of all human collectives and the power of self-interest and collective egoism in all intergroup relations. There's that notion about sin for Niebuhr, you know, the brutal character of human collectives. Failure to recognize the stubborn resistance of group egoism to all moral and inclusive social objectives inevitably involves there, that is, you know, liberal moralists, in unrealistic and confused political thought. In other words, if people don't realize that collectives are brutal and that they're motivated for the most part by self-interest, they come up with all sorts of crazy schemes that just won't work. They regard social conflict either as an impossible method of achieving morally approved ends or as a momentary expedient which a more perfect education or a pure religion will make unnecessary. They do not see that the limitations of the human imagination, the easy subservience of reason to prejudice and passion, and the consequent persistence of irrational egoism, particularly in group behavior, make social conflict an inevitability in history, probably to its very end. What Niebuhr was saying there is that when we're dealing with groups of people, we're dealing with people. People are basically self-interested, and groups of people are even more self-interested than individuals. And what we're talking about when we're talking about groups is power. Power means that there is going to be conflict, and Niebuhr didn't see any escape from that. He didn't think that by educating people better or by treating them better that you were ever going to change that about human behavior. That was one of the limitations of humans. And if you fail to recognize the fact that there's going to be conflict, the solution that you come up with to whatever problem you're working on is not going to work. It's unrealistic, let's say. He said, conflict is inevitable, and in this conflict, power must be challenged by power. You know, that's the way things are, Niebuhr would say, I guess. He goes on, he says, the following pages are devoted to the task of analyzing the moral resources and limitations of human nature and of tracing their consequences and cumulative effect in the life of human groups and of weighing political strategies in the light of the ascertained facts. The ultimate purpose of this task is to find political methods which offer the most promise of achieving an ethical social goal for society. And then he gets to the criteria. He says, such methods must always be judged by two criteria. One, do they do justice to the moral resources and the possibilities in human nature and provide for the exploitation of every latent moral capacity in man? In other words, if you're talking about a strategy for a group of people, does it make use of all, he doesn't think that people are without moral resources, that people have a lot of things that they can do. They've got a lot of possibilities. And whatever you come up with for a political strategy needs to take advantage of all of those good resources that people have. So that's the first one. Whatever you come up with has to take advantage of the possibilities of people. But the second one is, and it has to be held up with the first one. Again, here's the paradox. Do they take account of the limitations of human nature, particularly those which manifest themselves in man's collective behavior? At the same time that you're talking about the possibilities that people have, you also have to remember their limitations, and you have to hold those up together. You have to be aware of possibilities, but you also have to be aware of limitations. And that's the criteria that he's going to use as he goes through. And the rest of the book, basically, is if you look at the table of contents, he's just trying to do exactly that. He's trying to say, okay, what are the religious resources that people have to work out some kind of a meaningful society? What are the rational resources they have? You can look at the table of contents yourself, but then what are the limitations? And he just works that out through a series of chapters. He talks about the ethical attitudes of the privileged classes, people with money and influence and power. He talks about the ethical resources of the proletariat, that is the workers, the poorer folks. What kind of resources do they have, and what kind of limitations? He talks about revolution. He just works that out as he goes through what he considers to be the available options for people. Some of the interesting highlights in that book are as follows. He talks about nonviolence, for instance, as a tactic rather than a lifestyle. One of the things that he thinks about is again, he's saying that the conflict is inevitable and power needs to be opposed by power. Nonviolence, there's a power there. And it's a tactic. You can use nonviolence in the way Gandhi did in India, and it's very powerful. But he doesn't really consider it to be a lifestyle, as Gandhi maybe did. Gandhi thought he talked about truth force. Niebuhr sees this as one more option that people have, kind of like a strike or a police power or whatever. He talks about the necessity of coercion and even violence. He comes out of what we sometimes call in the Lutheran Church the just war tradition. Because people are the way they are, according to Niebuhr, there are certain instances in which violence is necessary in order to preserve order or whatever, to attain whatever goal society wants to attain. And that's really what this article I don't know if I have it here. Oh, Niebuhr versus Niebuhr. He argued with his brother in the pages of the Christian Century about what the United States ought to do in response to this invasion that the Japanese engaged in of Manchuria before World War II. And Reinhold Niebuhr felt that there ought to be some, the United States ought to act on that. Richard Niebuhr felt that they ought to stay out of it. And they both did so for theological reasons. So Niebuhr was one that believed that coercion and just war was sometimes necessary. He tried to convince people, his own people, liberals, socialists, pacifists, that during World War II the United States had to, that pacifism was not an option before the Second World War, that the United States needed to be involved on the side of the Allies against the Germans. And a lot of people felt that he was a turncoat. You can imagine a guy from the Fellowship of Reconciliation trying to convince his folks that they need to give up pacifism in this instance because this is a case of a just war. So that's kind of where he's coming from on that. Some other kinds of highlights. He praised Marxism for its ability to unmask the pretensions of every other political philosophy, especially capitalism. He really felt that Marx's criticisms of capitalism were right on the money. The problem with Marxism, he said, was its tendency to was its inability, first of all, to engage in self-criticism, and the tendency in Marxism to concentrate power in an elite. Whenever you talk about Marxist societies, it seems as though there, even though you imagine this sort of a utopian society in which everybody's equal and there's no stratification in the society, the classless society, it seems as though there's always an elite of people in which power is concentrated. You know, everybody's equal, but some people are more equal than others. And that was one of the things that Niebuhr criticized. That's a very, I think, a very timely critique of Marxism. There was a book published a couple of years ago by a sociologist by the name of Alvin Guldner called The Future of Intellectuals and the Rise of the New Class. And one of the things that he talks about in there is this tendency in socialism and Marxism for power to be concentrated in a group of people who either know more or somehow, for some reason, usually because of their knowledge, in the case of the new class, they know more. So everybody's equal, but these people are a little more equal. And we talk about that as being the new class. They're people that are educated, and they use their education as kind of the way the bankers used to use money. Guldner was real critical of that, and I think Niebuhr was too. Michael Novak, the neoconservative, who is a Niebuhrian, also criticizes people that he says are on the left of the spectrum because of that, you know, the new class. And it was real interesting, if you read that article by Novak in the Christian Century, that's one of the things he says that he uses Niebuhr for, is to critique that tendency among these supposedly classless societies to always have an elite that are more equal than everybody else who supposedly is equal. Niebuhr called the ethic of Jesus an impossible possibility. He felt like the ethic of Jesus was impossible for people. People could not live their lives on the basis of the Sermon on the Mount, and yet it was important that it be there because it gave us something to strive for. In the meantime, we had to figure out what we were going to do since we couldn't live that way. We had kind of a provisional sort of an ethic. He was constantly on guard against the moral pretensions of nations and groups who thought they could create the kingdom of God in both its religious form, which Protestant liberalism, I think, really thought it could do, and the secular version, which was Marxism, which was kind of a secular version of the kingdom of God on earth. Niebuhr said, you can't do that. The limitations on human beings, and especially on groups, will make that impossible. Richard Fox talks about this publication of Moral Man and Immoral Society. He says, the real historic significance of moral man and immoral society lay not in its call for proletarian, that is, worker fortitude, or even its justification of violence as an ethical resource. Many other radical Christians were making use of the same arguments, although none were doing so with the same analytical and rhetorical power. Its chief importance lay in Niebuhr's biting repudiation in the name of Protestantism itself of the historical Protestant quest for the kingdom of God. You know, here he was with all of his liberal colleagues who were basically trying to bring in the kingdom, and Niebuhr was telling them, you can't do it. It won't work, and these are the reasons why. And he just outraged his friends as a result of this. And Fox talks about that, that there were people that didn't speak to Niebuhr forever after that. Niebuhr saw society as a realm of power blocks that needed to be adjusted, rather than as a garden that needed regeneration. That was one of Fox's things. This was not a garden that needed to be tended and regenerated and then it would grow nice plants. We're talking about power politics here, and you need to adjust the power. So he was very, that's where I guess it gets its name. If you believe that that's what reality is like, Niebuhr would say that's realistic. Sidney Ahlstrom, who's a historian, he wrote this two-volume work, The Religious History of American People. He says, Moral Man and Immoral Society was Niebuhr's single most important book, and it was probably the most disruptive religious ethical bombshell of domestic construction to be dropped during the entire interwar period. Here was Niebuhr, Fellowship of Reconciliation, socialist, pacifist, kind of saying it's not going to work, and it really caught people off guard. In volume two of The Nature and Destiny of Man, I think there's some more mature kinds of reflection. Nature and Destiny of Man was written like 10 years after Moral Man and Immoral Society, and the stuff that he's got there is a little more mature, and it's a little more theological than the things in Moral Man and Immoral Society. That book was an attempt at kind of a synthesis of the Reformation insight, which Niebuhr said the thing about the Reformation was it finally got a notion of the fact that people were limited. There were some limitations on humans. That was the Reformation insight. And what he was attempting to do was to synthesize that with the Renaissance, which was also going on about that time. The Renaissance insight was into the possibilities of human beings. You know, while the Reformation was kind of saying, look, here are the limits. Luther was talking about sin. The Renaissance was saying, here are the possibilities. And what Niebuhr was trying to do was to put those two things together in some kind of a synthesis. And the jury's out, I guess, as to whether he succeeded in doing that. But again, that paradox, limits and possibilities, he's holding them up together. There's a couple of important concepts, I think, when we're thinking about Niebuhr, and again, this idea of adjusting these power blocks in society. There are two important concepts that he had that McCann talks about in that book, Christian Realism and Liberation Theology. One of them, he said, if you're thinking about a society in which you've got these different blocks of power that you're trying to adjust in some sort of a just way, and again, justice is very important for Niebuhr, one of the things that's important, he said, was the test of tolerance. You know, how are you going to deal, if you're in one power block with one set of ideological ideas, how are you going to deal with all these other people who have ideas, political and social ideas, that are different from yours? How are you going to work that out? He said the test of tolerance is real important. In a case where you've got this ideological conflict. He said the test is twofold, and it includes the ability of a person to hold vital convictions, in other words, a person to really believe what their position is, which lead to some sort of an action. You know, if I've got some vital convictions, I'm going to act on the basis of those convictions, because I really believe what I'm doing needs to be done. Okay, so that's the one thing. But also, along with that, the capacity to preserve the spirit of forgiveness towards those who offend us by holding convictions which seem untrue to us. Okay, there's going to be a lot of other people that have vital convictions and want to act as well. How am I going to deal with them, short of, shooting them? How are we going to work this out? There needs to be some sort of a spirit of forgiveness, an idea of tolerance between these people that seem to, or these groups that seem not to get along. Martin Marty, and he gets it from Gabriel Marcel, talks about a very similar idea when he talks about something he calls counter-intolerance. And that is the ability of someone to believe what they believe very strongly and yet recognize in a person who believes just the opposite of them that same conviction and belief that their position, even though it's different from mine, is similar. Marty says, who of all people should be able to understand what it means to hold vital convictions than somebody who holds them him or herself? It's a complex kind of an idea, but he calls it counter-intolerance, and it gets close to what Niebuhr was saying by the test of tolerance. You got to have vital convictions, you got to be willing to act, but you also have to have some spirit of forgiveness for somebody that holds a vital conviction that's different than yours. That was the first concept. The second one, he says, if you neglect the first part of that, in other words, you don't have any vital convictions and you don't act, that leads to cynicism. You're just cynical. You don't do anything. He says if you neglect the second one, where you're not willing to forgive and understand people that hold some other viewpoint, that leads to fanaticism. That's the kind of the holy war. You're either going to believe like I believe or you're going to be dead kind of thing. And he's trying to avoid that. So that's the first one, the test of tolerance. The second one was what he called the balance of power. The balance of power assigns to politics the special task of creating and maintaining what he called an organizing center capable of orchestrating the vitalities of the community without degenerating into two things now he's worried about. He doesn't want tyranny, which again is this kind of this order, order at all costs, no creativity, no dialogue, or on the other hand, total chaos and anarchy. Somehow you have to engage in some sort of a political system. You have to create a system where you can adjust these power blocks among these different groups so that there's some kind of dialogue going on and you don't have straight tyranny or complete anarchy. Okay, those are the things he's trying to avoid. In the Nature and Destiny of Man, in the second part, he says, He's talking about this vital center, okay, that's going to hold all this stuff together, maybe. He says, the center must arbitrate conflicts from a more impartial perspective than is available to any party of a given conflict. I mean, it's not as though you can say to one party in this dialogue, okay, you guys be in charge now, because if you make them in charge, they're going to make sure everybody believes the same way they do. You know, so how are you going to do that? That's the job of the vital center. He says it must manage and manipulate the processes of mutual support so that the tensions inherent in them will not erupt into conflict. It must coerce submission to the social process by superior power whenever the instruments of arbitrating and composing do not suffice. And finally, it must seek to redress the disproportions of power by conscious shift in the of the balances whenever they make for injustice. So he's trying to figure out, you know, how are we going to live here? How are we going to adjust these different groups? Niebuhr believed that the best way you can do that is through constitutional democracy. You know, he thought that a constitutional democracy was the way you could handle that. And he was a very articulate spokesperson, I guess, for democracy. Some of his other ideas, he talked about the hypocrisy of nations, including the United States. He was a strong anti-communist in the early 50s. He was not by any means a McCarthyite, but he was a strong anti-communist in the sense of he saw that as being a real threat to the United States. Marty talks about him, though, in his book, Pilgrims. This is Marty. He says, in Niebuhr's reading, the conflict with communism laid bare all the old American illusions. While Americans blasted communist materialism, they scanted their own idolatry of things, their worship of their own prosperity. They were blind to the fact that theirs was a paradise of domestic security suspended in a hell of global insecurity. We Americans, he went on, find it almost as difficult as the communists to believe that anyone could think ill of us, since we are persuaded as they that our society is so essentially virtuous that only malice could prompt criticism of any of our actions. That may make a lot of sense to people today, but you got to remember that he said that in 1952, and that was a dangerous thing to say for somebody. Even though he was an anti-communist in some respects, he was critical of the anti-communists as well. So, and Marty says, and I think rightly so, that that was a rather courageous thing for somebody to say in those days, because those were the days of blacklists and all that. Fox. Talks about in his book how the CIA, well, we didn't have a CIA then, the State Department followed Niebuhr through his whole career and were reluctant to give him a security clearance because he had ties in the 30s with all these socialist organizations, and some people actually tried to accuse him of being communist, you know, during that witch hunt in the early 50s. He said, human nature makes democracy both a necessity and a possibility. There's another paradoxical statement, according to Niebuhr, but it needs to be, I think, in fairness to Niebuhr, he would say it doesn't need to just be a political democracy. I think he would also say it needs to be an economic democracy, too. And, you know, there's a lot of people that talk about that today. Okay, so that's kind of his ideas, some of his basic ideas. What are the limitations of Niebuhr's approach? When you think about Niebuhr, he moved from a pacifist socialist who was sympathetic to Marx, to really a kind of an establishment cold warrior. And that movement has kind of led to a criticism of his approach of he's been accused of sort of an ideological drift. You know, he kind of just went along with the spirit of the times, people say. His ideas coincided with the ideas of the establishment. When he was a socialist and a pacifist, it was very, according to this criticism, it was chic to be a socialist and a pacifist. You know, and then he got into the New Deal, and after the Second World War, he was a cold warrior. You know, so, you know, maybe he wasn't always as critical as he could have been. He was viewed by some people, and he still is, as kind of an establishment theologian. You know, he's dealing with all of these people that are influential and powerful. If he's so prophetic, then why do the people in power like him? You know, the people in power never like prophets, but they like Niebuhr for the most part. So that's one of the critiques of, you know, and people will have to judge whether they think that's true or not. Another critique of him is that his perspective was that of a North American male who moved in the circles of power. And he had a tendency to universalize his perceptions. I want to talk a little bit about that on Thursday, but You know, Niebuhr made these sweeping statements about the nature and destiny of man and moral man and immoral society. And when you read it, you assume that this is true for all people everywhere for all time when you're reading his when you're reading his stuff. And the fact of the matter is that Robert McAfee Brown once said, what you see depends on where you stand, and what you hear depends on who you listen to. Niebuhr's ideas reflected the circles that he ran in, which were well-educated. They were white, they were male, they were North American, and his ideas reflected that world. They didn't necessarily reflect other parts of the world very well, and it's hard to universalize those and say those ideas are true for everybody, everywhere, for all time. He was very critical of people who tended to universalize particularities, you know, take one situation and make a sweeping universal statement, and yet he did it all the time. So. The world in Central America, for instance, among the poor, looks a lot differently than it did to Reinhold Niebuhr. You know, there's a different reality for somebody that lives in San Salvador than for somebody that teaches at Union Seminary in New York City and is flying around the country all the time. So that's another critique of Niebuhr's approach. Sometimes, another one is that his sense of human limitation could sometimes lead and did lead to cynicism. That was one of the things he was worried about, but it was kind of the idea that, well, you know, collectives are brutal in their nature, it doesn't get any better than this, so let's not rock the boat and let's just kind of go along with the system. You know, that same kind of temptation that Jim Nichterlein said Lutherans have a tendency toward, some people, maybe not so much Niebuhr as much as his followers, had a tendency toward that. There's almost a cynicism in some of his followers. So those are some of the limitations. And I want to talk a little bit more about some of them throughout the week, but you know, there's food for thought there, I think, for people. What are the possibilities of Niebuhr? I think he had a real realistic view of human nature. There were some holes in it, and again, I want to talk about that on Thursday, but there was something realistic about saying that people have incredible possibilities, but they also have limitations. You know, that's very Lutheran of him. You know, we can identify with that. People are saints and sinners at the same time, and Niebuhr really was into that. And I think that's, for me, that's reality. I think he also, there was a realistic quest for justice and for the necessity of being aware of the pretensions of all collectives, religious or secular. One of the things about groups of people, he said, is that they always tend to have these pretensions about themselves. They tend to assume when things are going right in the group that, you know, this is it. The kingdom of God has arrived and we're it. You know, and if the rest of the world would just sort of model us or join us, everything would be okay. Niebuhr was always critical about that, and I think that's a constant necessity that we need. It's kind of that self-critical sort of a thing. I think he's also a helpful critique, and I said a friendly critique, but a helpful critique of liberal and liberation theology due to that necessity of self-criticism. Robert McAfee Brown, again, who's very sympathetic to liberation theology, says one of the gifts that Niebuhr gives to us today is that idea of self-criticism, that you need to always be critical of every position, including your own. It's sometimes debatable whether he was, you know, critical enough of his own position, but that's a gift that he gives us, a possibility that's real important today. I guess in conclusion, I'd say I want to talk about a contemporary approach to Niebuhr's perspective. There's a book that none of you have probably ever heard of, I guess. I've given up, trying to think that people have heard of it, but you ought to hear of it. It's a book by a guy named Gerard Faure, who's a priest and also a physicist, oddly enough, in Belgium. And the book is called Liberation Ethics. It was published by Temple University in 1982. And he's got a very refreshing approach that really reminds you of Reinhold Niebuhr. There's a foreword in the book that's written by a guy named John Raines, and this is what he says about Gerard Faure, but he could be talking about Niebuhr. He says, Faure believes that the task of ethics must begin with analyzing the established power relationships, laying bare a given society's inner institutional relationships, and decoding its legitimating myths. That theologians can be aided in this task by the instruction of Karl Marx seems an irony that is not at all unacceptable. It is an irony which was last fully appreciated in this country by Reinhold Niebuhr. In his Moral Man and Immoral Society, Niebuhr brilliantly analyzed the class bias of conventional conscience. It is a bias which confuses propriety with morality, and while practicing minor virtue, routinely enjoys the fruits of major, that is, structural vices. Niebuhr's debunking of moral pretension in an age of frustrated ambition and anxious conformity, much like our own, was withering. Ferré breathes the same air of iconoclasm, and it is refreshing. It's kind of like Jesus' critique of the Pharisees. You know, the Pharisees had it all down. They could see the small things, but they couldn't see the big picture. And I think that's part of what Niebuhr was doing here in what Ferré does in that book, Liberation Ethics, is he says, look, let's take power seriously, and let's see who's got power and who doesn't and why they want things to be the way they are. I think that's something that we definitely need today. Because a lot of the ethical thinking, I guess, and religious thinking that I'm exposed to never talks about power, never takes power seriously, and so all of these power relationships are kind of disguised. You know, they're kind of under the table. And that's the kind of power I think that really hurts people, the power that people don't know about or aren't willing to admit. And I think Niebuhr is real helpful in analyzing that kind of thing. And I think Marxists and feminists, even if you don't like Marxism and you don't like feminism, one of the things that you can learn from them is that you know, they know about those power relationships and they expose them. And I think part of the reason why some of us don't like them so much is because they make us real uncomfortable when they show us what's really happening in society in terms of power relationships. Niebuhr is an ally there because I think he did that rather well. So let me stop there and let you respond to that or not respond.
You've spoken about Niebuhr's attitude toward people in collective bunches.
Yeah.
Does this type of thinking of the limitations of what the people in organized groups can do, does he apply this to churches, or is his thinking more in terms of political organizations?
Well, that's a real interesting question because I think, yes, he does apply it to churches, but one of the things about Niebuhr is that, and he's been criticized by it, by his brother, for one thing, H. Richard, is he doesn't have much of a theology of the church. He doesn't talk about the church very much. And I'm not going to talk, when I talk about Niebuhr, I'm not going to talk about the church very much because he doesn't talk about it. But, you know, it's hard to know. He started off in the evangelical synod. You know, he was a parish pastor for a long time, and he was very active in the German evangelical synod in the church in his own parish and in the broader church of the German evangelical synod. But when he got to Union, he started to deal with people that didn't really have real close ties with any one denomination. And toward the end of his life, he wasn't dealing so much with theological people or church people. He was dealing with people in the State Department and politicians and people who might just have a real tangential relationship to the church. And his thought reflects that. I think I can't give you a citation on this. I think that he would say that, yeah, churches are one of the collectives that tend toward taking themselves much more seriously than they ought to, and tend to universalize what they say is real, and are unaware of sometimes their own pretensions. His criticism in Moral Man and Immoral Society was directed a lot at church people, who especially Protestant liberal church people, who really felt like if we can just get our ducks in a row, you know, the kingdom of God is going to happen right here in America. And Niebuhr said, no, that's not going to happen. He doesn't talk a lot about the church specifically, but I think that the criticisms that he makes of collectives apply to the church as well as to any other group. But that's a real good question because he doesn't say a lot about the church, and he's criticized by his brother for that.
I'm not familiar with Niebuhr, but I get a sense that he was either a joiner or affiliated with as many power groups as he could to perhaps not get labeled as being a staunch enforcer of any one power group. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it was that he was real hyperactive. The adrenaline that this person must have had is incredible. But yeah, I think he was, he was always starting. You know, when you read this biography, it's amazing because like any time there was a crisis or a situation that he felt needed some response to, he and a group of his friends would get together and they'd start an organization, and then they'd have that one for a while, and he never did any of the organizational stuff, you know, that was for somebody else. But then the next crisis would come up and they'd start another organization, and those were the kind of things that the State Department, they, when they were running this security check on him, were, you know, look at all the stuff this guy's been in, you know, and some of these look sort of pink to us. He was a joiner in a sense. It was hard to pigeonhole him. Again, people say that toward the end of his life it was got easier to pigeonhole him. He was establishment. Toward the end of his life, he was an anti-communist, and it was real hard for him to come out and oppose the Vietnam War, for instance. But he did toward the end of his life. He felt like it was the wrong war, the wrong place, and all that. But he was not one of the early people. You know, he felt like that was another place, at least initially, where the United States needed to make a stand against, you know, Soviet expansionism. And only later, as the thing started to unfold, did he become critical of it before he died. And again, he died in 71. But he was a joiner, and he was also a complete extrovert and running on adrenaline all the time. He slept very little. According to Fox, it took him a couple hours in the morning to get going. You know, he'd get up people picture him as wreathed in clouds of blue smoke and coffee. And, you know, he's students that talk about going into his office. But he was also very gracious to students. He answered all of his mail. You know, people would write him letters from, Holden Village or Portland, Oregon, and he'd answer them. He was never condescending to people. He was, you know, like Fox calls him someplace, the consummate Democrat. He treated people with respect. Fox says it was impossible for Niebuhr to condescend to somebody. You know, he would look them in the eye and treat them as an equal, no matter who they were. And people responded to that in him, I guess. So, yeah.
You mentioned that some people would critique Niebuhr for being an establishment figure.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think that's very fair. Because, first of all, you start out in the 20s as a pastor, and he's fighting Henry Ford in Detroit.
Right.
Then he becomes a socialist and a pacifist, which is hardly, it wasn't really fashionable to be either of those things anytime. I think when he changed in the later 30s and 40s and 50s, he changed his mind.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't think he sold out.
No.
I think that, you know, he, when we think of anti-communism, what we forget is Arthur Schlesinger has said, when you're talking about anti-communism in the 40s and 50s, say anti-Stalinism. Then it's easier.
Yeah, I think that's
helpful.
He saw that
the Stalinist regime was a monstrous regime.
Sure.
He turned against it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, while he did that, you had that one quote showing it, he had the incredible gift of maintaining the self-criticism. That is, to say that communism was wrong and must be opposed was not the same thing as saying America is always right and everything about us is glorious.
Yeah.
He always avoided the trap, I think, which some more establishment figures would get into, because they're wrong, we are right.
Right.
And what you say at the end, you know, about Vietnam, he may have come to it late, but I remember reading in New Republic, it was the last thing he ever published. A critique of the war in the late 60s, before he died. And it's very powerful and very strong.
Yeah.
And at that time, it still wasn't all that popular. I think Niebuhr was a man, as far as I can see of him, really was always his own man.
Yeah.
And if he changed, it's because his ideas changed and not because he was responding to popular needs or to getting in with someone.
Yeah.
At least that's my reading.
I think that's real helpful, you know, I have a tendency to agree with that too. There are people that don't, obviously, but I think, you know, he was, the thing about it is, as soon as you, it's not that he was totally inconsistent, because there was a consistency to his thinking throughout, but it was almost like he could be self-critical, and those were things that people thought they were his political allies, when he would turn that self-criticism onto whatever group they were allied with him on, some people just couldn't handle it, you know, and they would think, you know, Niebuhr sold out or Niebuhr's turned on us. But what he was doing was trying to again, practice that rigorous self-discipline of self-criticism and thanks.
I just this summer been introduced to James Cone, who is in his book, God of the Oppressed.
Uh-huh.
He dismisses a major slate of theologians, particularly white theologians,
uh-huh.
because their agenda of pressing issues is deficient and has major blind spots, and
uh-huh.
Randall Niebuhr is one of those.
Uh-huh.
That Cone criticizes as having a limited agenda that doesn't take account of major injustices in the world, even
mm-hmm.
though he's supposedly pursuing justice.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, when you were making the comments about he's associated with the power institution, the circles and trials and the issues, then someone like James Cone says, yes, you see there, you know.
Right.
Niebuhr is not right on. He's really missing major marks. So, you know, you can...
Sure.
And on the other hand, I can say, I understand that what he deals with is what is brought to his attention. And the issues that James Cone is dealing with, people were conveniently or just simply ignorant,
uh-huh.
not dealing with. I mean, Niebuhr has a context. All of us do.
Right.
James Cone.
And I think that's real important to remember, that Niebuhr has a context. You know, it makes sense for us, you know, being who we are, to I mean, Niebuhr says a lot of things to us that are right on.
And we're objective.
I got a feeling that if we were, you know, if we were people in South Africa, blacks in South Africa, we might have to turn to somebody else because, you know, the context of Niebuhr's thought was, you know, not dealing with the reality. You know, that I love that statement by Brown. You know, what you see depends on where you stand, and what you hear depends on who you listen to. And that was true of Niebuhr. That's true of everybody. The problem, I guess, with Niebuhr is, in with a lot of theologians and pastors, you know, myself included, is that you know, the tendency to universalize what's really particular and contextual, and to say, you know, this is true in this situation now, and therefore it's true forever about all situations every place. And I think especially Judith Plasko and some of the feminist and liberation theologians are saying not that Niebuhr is all wet, but that he's not the only, it's the difference between a chorus and a solo. We had a student in one of the courses I was teaching at Portland State that took on Niebuhr, and one of the things she said is, you know, Niebuhr's got a great voice, he's just got to learn to be how to be a member of the chorus instead of being a soloist all the time. And I, you know, there's some truth to that, I think. Yeah.
Did Niebuhr address himself to how a group gain more power, and especially say at the expense of another group? Was that part of his writing?
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, I think that's part of it. A group gains power sometimes at the expense of another group. The group tends to act, individuals tend to act out of their own self-interest, he would say, but individuals have some moral possibilities that groups don't. I think he believed that when people get into groups, those kinds of things that kind of mitigate their self-interest, you know, the ethics of self-sacrifice, for instance, the ethic of Jesus and that kind of thing, that might be a possibility for me as an individual Christian. But as soon as we get a bunch of folks together, you know, that no longer becomes a realistic, you know, sort of an ethic for us. Yeah, groups really tend to have a collective ego and to act in their own self-interest. So he kind of had this, what some people, I think he called it someplace, this frank dualism in morals. You know, some things were morally true of an individual. The ethic of Jesus was an impossible possibility, but an individual might be able to approximate it. You get a bunch of people together, and they're never going to be able to act in the interest, on the basis of the ethic of Jesus. And if they do even approximate it, they're going to become so self-righteous that nobody's going to be able to stand to be around them. Now, a guy that takes that on and takes Niebuhr on is a Yoder in the Politics of Jesus. And he says, you know, wait a minute, Niebuhr. He doesn't necessarily address specifically Niebuhr, but he addresses that notion. And he says, you know, maybe we ought to take the ethic of Jesus more seriously for groups of people, not groups of all people, but for Christians, people who say they're followers of Jesus, than we've been led to believe in the past by people like Niebuhr. Maybe there really is a way of living as a group, you know, that the New Testament and Jesus line outlined for us. I don't think he, at least not that I'm aware of, he didn't talk about how people get power at the expense of other people. I think he just assumed that they'll figure out a way, you know. It's kind of like they'll find a way.
Some peasant in, say, Central America or some intellectual, in the interest of the peasant in Central America, would not necessarily go to him as a...
For a strategy.
Yeah.
I think in response to both of these, actually there are parts of moral man and moral society, I think that a liberation theologian could very much go to.
Yeah.
When he talks about the proletariat, and he talks about, you know, he waffles back and forth on whether power is justified, when it's justified. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he says very clearly, he says basically the use of power is generally morally more acceptable on the part of the oppressed than of those of the powerful. And so there, and he also talks in parts of Moral Man and Moral Society about colonialism and imperialism, mm-hmm. and he has very strong things, anti-imperialist, Native peoples to say. I mean, it's not a major thing, but it's there in the book. And if you translate, if you use that and then translate also his views on the proletariat, and the idea that he says that, you know, people that have power, they don't give it up very easily. Mm-hmm. And there are situations where the oppressed, the only way, finally, they have to achieve power may be to fight for it, literally.
Right, revolution.
So that I think that, you know, that's not all Niebuhr's.
Right.
But there certainly are sections that a liberation theologian could use, I think, very effectively from Niebuhr, and those who are, however you define the oppressed, can use. He certainly has it in Moral Man and Moral Society.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like there needs to be a, you talk about the limitations of the collective, then you're talking about the possibilities of the collective. And it would seem that whatever the notion of body of Christ,
mm-hmm.
something like that. Mm-hmm. Does he deal with that at all?
Well, I think you're right, but I don't think he, you know, that was not on his agenda, you know, specifically.
That's something we
are. That, when we're going to read Niebuhr, you know, we need to temper him, at least include that with what our reflections are. I don't think he had a totally negative attitude toward the church. But he was probably more ambivalent about the church than, you know, a lot of people that come to, well, maybe I can't make that generalization, a lot of people that come to Holden Village. He had some ambivalent feelings, and he tended to neglect that part. There were some things, you know, you can't say everything, and he didn't. And that was one of the things he didn't say as much about as maybe some people would have wished that he would have.